Okay, so I want to start by showing you, if you like, a little bit what is the process of angiogenesis. So I guess you're familiar with this process of tumor generation, the mutation of certain cells, their agglomeration, and then eventually these tumor cells are emitting growth factors. And then these growth factors are telling nearby endothelial cells to sprout. That's at least one of the mechanisms. And then you get vascularization of the tumor. This has different effects on the tumor microenvironment. First of all, it brings oxygen to the tumor. Also, it happens that these blood vessels are quite leaky, and that changes the pressure around the tumor. And the other thing that happens is that you get, because of the gaps in the junctions between the blood vessels, you get some of the tumor cells that are entering into the circulation, and you have this process of metastasis. So this is just to show you some of the phenomena that are of interest. And the next thing that I want to tell you is that I come from the field of fluid mechanics, and I just have an interest in transport phenomena. So I will be looking in certain transport phenomena in tumors. So for example, things that are of interest to me is this enhanced pressure in the microenvironment, blood flow, and how does this bring oxygen into the tumor, and also the process of metastasis is something that I have an interest. Now, what I'd like to tell you is a story today, and it's a story about what may be possible to do coming from a field like fluid mechanics and trying to bring ideas into the field of cancer biology. So some of these slides, maybe you have seen them before, but just to give you a motivation of where I'm coming from, I'm fascinated by structures like this that you observe in nature, and structures like this are characterized by a thin film, by breakup of the thin film and very adaptively formed structures. And what you see up there actually is another structure that I'll tell you in a moment what both of them are. But I'm fascinated by the similarities between the two, and I'm interested in developing methods that will be able to capture such phenomena and such structures. And for those of you who want to know, one is from fluid mechanics, is the process of ground breakup, and the other is the process of vasculogenesis.
And that's Talos, right? That from the array.
I'm sorry?
Isn't that the Greek philosopher Talos?
Tapanta Ray, yeah. Yeah, you're very good. So actually, Tapanta Ray or Tapanta Ri? That's the question. So so what things we are interested in throwing at this process is, so some of the things
What's
I'm interested
in. Breakup?
I'm sorry?
What is crown breakup?
Crown breakup is when you have this droplet that falls on the hot seat, and as it rebounds, it generates all this breakup on its surface. That's what is there. That's it. Well, that's it. Let me go and play it again. There's crown breakup. So just to show you some of the tools that I'll be using for this talk, and where I'm coming from is I'm coming, as I said, from the field of fluid mechanics and turbulence, and I'm interested, for example, in simulating aircraft wakes, and the way we do that is we do it by using some quite large-scale simulations. Did I lose them? No, they're here. So we're able to do billions of particles to simulate continuum phenomena. This is a simulation of a wake where we have used 10 billion particles, 16,000 cores, and this involves long-range interactions because we solve the Poisson equation. And today we can also fix the problem of shock bubble interaction. I just showed you because it's beautiful, and because we have, I think, the record in doing large-scale flow simulations. This has 300 billion particles, and it runs in 30% efficiency on 40,000 cores. So perhaps, unlike what has been the theme here, because I come from the numerical background, I try perhaps to complicate my models, perhaps unnecessarily so, but I try to compensate for this complication by numerics and computation. Again, another view of this process of angiogenesis. Again, the tumor, the extraction of the growth factors, and again, I'm just showing you this. This is from Ross when they were advertising the Avastin, which we know what happened. But just to show you what I like about this is to show you these junctions that you see in the endothelial cells, and that you have a vasculature that has leakage, and also that you see this process of metastasizing tumor cells. I'll come back to these junctions that you see here. Now, so you will be seeing at the end somewhere of the talk how we go about computing things like that.
This is the result of computation, not illustration.
No, this is the last thing I showed is the result of a computation that I'll tell you about. So given that I know how things are going here, I'd like to tell you what the talk contains, first of all. So the talk contains computations that involve, and I'll tell you how we do computations of this type of models that I believe other people talked about, like dissipative particle dynamics, and how we can make a combination of dissipative particle dynamics to form cells of this kind and look at proliferation schemes. It's referring to imaging, so we are interested very much in wound healing assays, and I'll be showing you also some imaging techniques that help me to characterize different lumen formation and different structures, and you will be seeing something that's called curvelets that I'll be using for that. I'd like to show you simulations of doing, not simulations, but show you imaging tools for doing cell tracking in wound healing assays, and what is necessary in order to get such images as what you see here. There is also work that we have been doing with a group from UCLA on retina and trying to extract retina formation. This is another topic that I'll be talking about, how to quantify this kind of structures that you observe in retina, because we are interested in quantifying images, and you will be seeing...
In Rima, Arispe will actually give a talk here.
Excellent. So I'll get to see her again. we collaborate on this project. I want to talk also, if you are interested at some point, I want to talk on how to generate models from data. And this is a project where actually the reason I'm doing imaging and simulation is because I want to use the images to do data and the way to do models. And the way I do this, I can show you a very complete example of how I did it for virus transport, where I use reverse engineering ideas to extract parameters for a stochastic model of virus transport in microtubules. This is my most complete work in reverse engineering. The other things that I'll show you is towards this complete work. And just some more simulations I'll be showing you. This is diffusion, frap-like diffusion on the surface of the endoplasmic reticulum. There is other things that are in the menu, like how to do reaction diffusion equations on surfaces, and not only on surfaces, but also on deforming surfaces as well. And finally, there will be simulations of tumor formation, like this one, and also you will be having models of necrosis. I'm not going to be able to talk about all these things. I'm just showing you because this is a great opportunity for me to have an audience like yourselves to be able to get feedback in all these things. And one of the last things I want to show you is how to do simulations of angiogenesis in a realistic extracellular matrix, if you like, where there is blood vessel growth, there is reaction diffusion taking place in the lumen and on the surface, there's bound growth factors, soluble growth factors, a complicated geometry, and thousands of hours of CPU going to such an animation. So this is the menu. Please, there's many other goodies in here. Please feel free at some point, maybe after the start of the, maybe actually I was thinking of making it interactive in asking you what do you want to see first.
Quick question, how do you cite up the extracellular matrix?
How do I what?
Geometry, at least, matrix.
How do what?
How do you cite it up?
Here I have set it up by taking two balls, sticks like that, uh-huh. and combine them all together in an artificial geometry. And I know how to represent units like this, and this is a linear superposition of units like this in this extracellular matrix.
Then how do you judge whether it's realistic or biological?
Well, the biological matrix is coming up because I will not show it here, but we are collaborating with biologists who are giving us such geometries, and I'll tell you how we discretize such geometries. So maybe I can start from telling you about such geometries, if you like.
If there's one of the other topics which the audience is particularly interested in, a part of embryogenesis, then I can set up an afternoon discussion. It's up to the audience.
Okay. So let me start by telling you perhaps a little bit about tools. I put this thing up because by my background, I'm a naval architect. So we're building tools, and I presume that there are people around here who are sailors. So representing cells, so there's different ways of representing cells. There is the cellular pots technique, there's cellular automata, and there is continuum techniques, and they are all very valuable, and this is my personal idea of how you can quantify the detail that you can have, the size of the system you can have, the cost per cell, and the realism. And this is very subjective because it usually depends very much on how you set up your questions. From the continuum point of view, and again coming from fluid mechanics, we were interested in solving equations of this form. They're usually, if you can take this, there's a divergence term that I miss in here. If you take that, you can formulate it as an advection type of a problem. So we're using particles, the particles that I use are solving basically Newton's equation. So what I do is I take particles, I formulate conservation laws like the Navier-Stokes equations, if you like, in the Lagrangian form. The right-hand side can be the divergence of any stress tensor, in fact, so in principle we can also do solids. And then what you do is you move particles and you follow them as you resolve these types of equations. So the trick is to take the differential operators and translate them into integral operators and then use particles as quadrature of points. And then the alternative from the molecular dynamics world, if you like, this is coarse-grain simulations of nanoparticle transport on membranes, is you coarse-grain or you develop certain potentials and then all the model or all the physics that you have are entering in here. And what is the thing that we do is we try to find that this is, we claim that this is kind of a unifying approach. And what we try to do is we try to develop codes where by changing the right-hand side, if you like, you can simulate different types of phenomena.
And the whole, capital D?
I'm sorry?
When is capital D?
This is the Lagrangian derivative.
Like in the Navier-Stokes equation.
It's D, it is equal to partial derivative ddt plus u dot grad operator. That's the operator.
I see. Okay.
So if you have particles and you follow them and you follow them according to dxdt is equal to u, your usual Navier-Stokes equations are like that. Divergence of sigma on these particles, this becomes a differential equation. So it's adaptivity that you get from that. But it's in a sense kind of similar adaptivity that as you get for following other particles and changing whatever properties they may have.
And the bottom picture is simulating nanoparticle interacting with the surface? Or?
That's right, with a membrane, with a lipid bilayer membrane, coarse-grain.
Is that a liposome that has affinity for the membrane?
Well, what we are doing is we're changing the hydrophobicity. We are putting patterns of different hydrophobic and hydrophilic behavior, and we are interested to see what is the possibility of uptake of these nanoparticles by the membrane. So we have, that can be, every one of these is a talk on its own, if you're interested.
In fact, Fuyu might later talk on nanoparticle delivery of
antitumor agents. That's of extreme interest to me.
Maybe if you would, at that time, agree to talk about simulations of nanoparticle
delivery,
we can have a nice session on this.
Yeah, I think I talk too much, so I'd like to hear more. So now this last thing that I showed you down here, with the right-hand side being the model of putting things in here, we are developing a method where initially we're considering that each cell is perhaps a single particle, and then we decide how each one of these cells is mutating, how it's duplicating itself, how is it polarized, and how do you get all this proliferation. And now a more recent model that we have done is to take other concepts where we take particles that they have a certain nucleus, and then we have a lot of other particles in here representing the cell. And again, we're deciding different rules, if you like, on how to do simulations of
what's
the blue is a membrane.
No, that's the rules.
I can come to that. I'll come to that.
How much time does this simulation take instead of computer time?
These two are real time. These are easy. Mm-hmm. These are very small.
Okay.
These are very small.
Yeah.
So here's the rules. So there is this technique called subcellular element method that was first proposed by Timothy Newman, I believe, in Arizona. And what's the idea of Newman and his student Sebastian Sanderschus? Is to take molecular dynamics, if you like, and translate them into molecular dynamics for cells. So people who do chemistry and such things, or soft matter, they're using this technique of molecular dynamics where you specify a potential between particles to interact. And then after you calibrate what are the parameters of these potentials, then you can have certain predictions about properties such as diffusion constants or pressure or temperature of certain configurations. And the idea here is to take, basically we're following these subcellular elements. So what you saw before on the right is, on the left was DPD, on the right with proliferation, the right is subcellular elements. And the idea is that you have different cells. And then what you start to do is you start to define potentials, and in these potentials you are defining intercellular interaction rules. You define intra, actually this is intra and this is inter, and intercellular rules, and you can actually continue and define separate rules for the membrane. You can actually try to model some kind of microtubule, and this is a direction that we are following, and that's actually, this is some of the rules that we can put inside this machinery. So we can define polarization by randomly fluctuating a vector, and then we can see what kind of a configuration we get. We can introduce some kind of chemotaxis, and then we have some elongation of the cell, and when it exceeds a certain distance, then we decide to split it. Density, polymerization, depolymerization. So you can put, it's a flexible framework that you can put any kind of rule that you decide. And then here's some of the things that we get. This is a totally randomly fluctuating polarization vector, just to show you the kind of pictures that we are capable of getting.
I have a question about,
please.
So vortices, what does vortices represent? So those are subcellular elements, and how many vortices can you have per cell?
It depends on what kind of computational capacity I have. Again, this is something that I think is real time, because it's 2D and it's not very many. What do you mean, how many I can have?
Because you said intercellular and intercellular.
You can decide. It's up to you to decide. You have the flexibility to, obviously the more, these things scale like n, with the number of points that you have.
So the more you have a better resolution, that's it.
you have more degrees of freedom. I want to come back to that because that's important. So you can have here also some density aware polymerization where cells are polymerizing according to the density that they feel from their neighbors, and that is where you get a lot of different patterns than the random. And that's where I want to pause for a moment and tell you that I have been playing with all these particle methods, and by taking all these particle methods, at some point I had the great chance of going to the lab of Doug Hanahan, who is at UCSF. I did not know Doug Hanahan. I said to a colleague, I want to learn about cancer. So he says, go to this lab of a friend of mine. I was very fortunate to go to the lab of Doug Hanahan. He's the person who has written this beautiful paper, The Hallmarks of Cancer, and then I went there and I was starting to do the whole thing, pipetting, killing mice, taking out tumors, and doing all these things. Please,
before we go into cancer, can you just explain a little more about what's happening with little balls there? So, you have color-coded stuff on the surface.
This is the membrane, the rules?
Yeah. So what exactly are the rules? So obviously the membrane is...
I don't remember.
And the edge
I have
of,
to look more.
Of the bulk. And then what, are they connected to each other?
Yes, they're connected to each other and they have certain types of potentials that they have parameters.
I guess I don't quite understand, so the...
So there's different rules of how particles interact, right? It's like molecular dynamics. And then I distinguish particle rules that happen only between these particles, okay? And then I distinguish between particle rules of interaction from membrane to particles in the interior.
So when you say these particles, I'm so searching for maybe a better definition.
Cellular elements is...
So what is what exactly is the inside and the outside? So so it's a convex shape.
That's right, yeah.
And the edges, only the ones that are specified.
That's right, you specify a priori.
If, for example, it bends over and...
It's 2D at the moment, huh?
But, I understand, right? But I can certainly imagine a sort of concave boundary where the two neighbors, which are not very close, you know, which are maybe three edges apart, will come very close together.
And then you have to cook something.
So do you cook anything?
Yes,
or?
We cook a lot. We cook a lot.
Okay, so I shouldn't take this too seriously because there's a lot of cooking that is not shown.
Yes, and the reason that I, as I was telling the story about Hanahan, is because I went to the lab and I said, what I'm doing is crap. It's irrelevant, and I was very depressed. And that's what I said, that everything that you see here, as you say, is animations, and there's a lot of cooking that I get different phenomena. So my next story was, I would like to have some way to quantify the uncertainty and all the parameters that I have into my models. And this is the reason, just the second, that I started looking into wound healing assays myself, because I wanted to use reverse engineering ideas to fix all these rules and all these parameters in a systematic way, and I want to show you this process after that. Please.
No, I'm just...
The number of particles which you define the cell has not changed in time.
The one cell, no, it does not define. But the cells, as soon as you decide that you want to split it, you have the flexibility actually, if you like, to make the cell grow. You can induce and sort them. All I'm telling you is this is a framework for cooking, and there's a lot of parameters, and the main message that I want to say for all the simulations that we do is that we have to work with experimentalists. I find it imperative, and I would like to put error bars around my simulations, and not only to cover one value. So I'd like to show you, for example, some examples of how I have done this process so that you can get an idea. So I'll show you an example of how we did, for example, particle methods for diffusion in the endoplasmic reticulum, because this was my start of getting images from biologists and then trying to use simulations to calibrate the parameters of the simulations. So just to tell you now, so this is discrete particles, what I was showing you here, with rules. Now the other kind of particles that you can get is that you can get particles for a continuum system. And in a continuum system, you can, so I can do it for derivative operators, I will show you in a second. But let's just take a function and see how it is approximated by particles. You take a function, you write it as an integral, and then you have the possibility of writing a point particle approximation where you just take a quadrature of this. Now, if you take this delta function and you want to have information between the particles, you use a function here. And now, this function can have different properties depending on the moments that this function has similar to the moments of the delta function. That's what determines the accuracy of this approximation. So if you have a Gaussian or only positive functions, this is approximation is second order. If you want to have higher order approximations, you go with functions that they have negativity. But then you have to have you have issues when approximating positive quantities such as density, etc.
Are you actually using finite element analysis?
No. No. Actually, this is a talk I gave on the other side. Particle methods, you can prove in some sense that they're a superset of finite difference methods, and actually they're kind of a superset of finite element methods. Because, yeah, we can talk about that separately.
I didn't want to interrupt you.
No, it's fine. So if I have a function, there's two parameters that come to play, two length scales. The filtering that you do by your particles, and the filter refers to the integral, and then the particles have a distance. So one of the problems for particle methods with continuum simulations is when particles go apart, then you have a problem in your approximation. But I want to show you, so how do I represent the endoplasmic reticulum? So here it's an endoplasmic reticulum. All I do is I put down a cube of particles, and then any complex surface that you have, I use an implicit representation for the surface, and then I decide who's inside, who's outside. And then the challenge is, how do I make differential operators for this kind of particles? I show it to you, here's how you make particle approximations for the function. It will do the same if you assume that the function is a Laplacian. I can do something similar for the Laplacian operator. A very simple way to see for the Laplacian is just come over here and take the second derivative of that. You will be taking the second derivative of that. This is the summation of the Laplacian. This is not conservative, we can fix it, but just to see quick with operators.
What's the h in your space?
H is the distance between particles.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Size, and h is their distance. And for particle methods to work, there is all these techniques called SPHs. I think they don't work. And h has to be less than epsilon. So the particles have to talk to each other. Mm-hmm. If they don't talk to each other, you cannot do correctly these approximations. So here's how we do level sets. Here's how we do surfaces now, because surfaces is something I need for blood vessels, is something I need for tumors. And what we do is you have a surface, and what you do is you embed it into a level set. That means you extend it by a sine distance function, if you like. So instead of having to discretize a singular function, what you do is you discretize a function in a higher dimension. This is more costly, but it allows you to use the usual volume operators, and I'll tell you why is it also very interesting for many other things. But also it's not so bad, because we only need to discretize a narrow band around here, because all we care is about this surface and how does it evolve. So now if I have a surface, how does it evolve? Well, you can come here and you can decide a velocity field that tells you how the surface is evolving. So this is a law that tells me the surface is evolving. So this U now can be, it's a degree of freedom where you can model a lot of things. You can model, let's say, curvature-driven flow, that you can make this U to be proportional to the curvature of the surface. How does the surface evolve? Or I will show you in a second how you can make it to be, for example, some property of the surface that you have on it, some reactants, for example. Now, with particles, this is very simple how you do it. You discretize the function like this, and you move the particles, and you don't change their strength. It's as clean as it gets for doing surfaces. I was very surprised that people bother to solve this with Eulerian methods. This is a clean way to do that. And here's one of the things that we do. We have a surface, and that I will come to if possible, but maybe I'll skip it because it's too... So I have a surface, and on this surface, I'm solving a reaction diffusion equation on surfaces. I can do that, I can show you if you like how I do that, and then I decide that my surface is moving according to the concentration of one of the reactants that I have over here. And then I can get different,
So how do you keep track of the surface with particles? I mean, there can be overhangs, there can be bubbles.
Here, this is the surface by the particles. So you put down the particles, and then this is the linear superposition of their individual volume. So you can imagine us having spherical functions around each one of them. And you take all of them, and then that's you approximate the function in a volume now, because you have extended the function by the level set. That's all I do. Is it clear? Or?
But when you move them, hopefully they don't detach from the surface and stuff.
Well, I continue introducing particles as my function changes.
Okay.
Yes. Yes. I continue.
So they keep overlapping because.
That's right. That's the key point. The key point is that you have to have particles h over epsilon less than one. If this breaks down, the thing gives you garbage. So you have to find ways to keep reinserting particles, and I can tell you how we.
So when you reinsert particles, you just interpolate the values.
I conserve moments of the field between two sets of particles. So everything is about moment conservation between one set of particles and a new set of particles, but I conserve moments of the field they carry. So depending for example, I use interpolation formulas that are moment conserving because I like to maintain this moment conservation for my approximation here. So that's I can tell you more details if you like about that. So then what I do is we're using this narrowband formulation and to solve equations, reaction diffusion equations on surfaces, and then the surface is moving according to the reaction, and I'm able to track it. I'm able to get things like that. What you see here is a cutout to show you what's inside, what are the tools, and this is where my particles are operating, and you can actually see how they evolve a little bit and get reprojected, etc. Problem with this is whenever these two things may touch, I'm dead. Okay, so then I have to introduce a rule of how things are detaching. Now, we have done more work on this. So what is the new thing that we have, which is quite unique, is we can, because we started running into problems in issues here, then we wanted to, this depends on the cell. At some point, your cell size decides when this thing is going to be cut. This is curvature-driven flow, curvature-driven surface deformation. You have two different curvatures, one here, another one here, and then this thing evolves. It's a standard benchmark problem, and this thing breaks apart. We have combined wavelets and particles, and we can do multi-resolution particle methods. What does this mean? It means that if you have a smooth part of your domain, then you can have fewer particles, and then whenever you have some criteria, then you can start to refine. And this is again happening all in a very adaptive manner. So this is changing different sizes of particles, so we can have multi-resolution representation of surfaces, if you like, which is important for certain problems that develop very, very narrow casts. So these are the tools. I have these discrete things where I have degrees of freedom or cooking utensils, if you like, which are the force field between the parameters. And the same way as in molecular dynamics, you need some calibration and validation for these parameters. I'm very much interested for a similar system for my discrete system that is supposed to represent cells. Okay, and that is actually why I went into the imaging domain, because I started working with biologists and I was interested in different quantitative information, but this quantitative information was not always there. So here's something that we did for vasculogenesis, and we actually use for wound healing assays, and this is a software actually that is free on the web and you can have. The idea is to process images and to look into now some of the wound healing assays and other imaging tools, other assays that biologists have, is to develop tools to get quantitative information out of them. So this is the other part. So I'm using something called curvelets, and this was developed by Emmanuel Candes at Caltech. And the idea of curvelets is a relative of wavelets, and wavelets are a way of compressing an image. So you have an image, you do a wavelet analysis of it. It's like a filtering operation. And then depending on how many terms you keep in the wavelet expansion, you can recover a compression ratio of 32:1. It's not the exact image, but you get the idea. If you do curvelets, this is also another type of compression, but what curvelets do is they're preserving edges in better way than wavelets. Now, why this is interesting? So I was interested first. So the way I have been learning is I've been going to biology labs, and usually it has been the case that they would give me things to plot for them or to analyze for them, whatever. So it's all an ad hoc thing, if you like. But again, in my mind, is I want data for my simulations. I want to quantify my models. So here is a quantification of two formation assays, and then this is a non-treated type of cells, and they make these very nice tubes. And also for biologists, it was interesting to quantify how many tubes you have and how many sheet-like areas you have. And then they treated the cells, and then you get a different picture. And now the idea is, how do I quantify what is different between this picture and this picture? So here's what we did. So we did this curvelet transform. This is worked by Michael Bergdorf in our lab. So we do a curvelet transform, and this is, we maintain only one level, so it's a very coarse description. This is the center of the active curvelets, but curvelets are actually interesting because they have also directional information. So this is the basis has direction. So then we wanted to use this property of looking at what kind of compression we get to distinguish it between tubes and sheets. So this is the picture that you get around the tube, that you get very distinct orientation and size of curvelets, and this is what you get around a sheet. So you get things that are, so this is very sharp, and you get a very high curvelet coefficients, and they have a certain orientation. And when you have sheets, then you get almost fewer of those because they're uniform, if you like, around this orientation, and that helps us to classify tubes and seats in an automated fashion. So we can go back and by processing, doing image analysis, we can tell them what is the total length, what is the sheet area, and vice versa when we go to this image. So this is data now, so these are numbers that I'm after that I would like to use for my process. Please.
Ask question, so what's the treatment in this case, and what are you trying to gain?
The biological treatment, I don't remember what it is. What they are trying to see is they have certain kind of cells, then they put them in a certain chemical environment, and instead of the cells making lumens and vasculatures, they change and they make sheets. Mm-hmm. And that's where my knowledge of biology stops.
So the idea of the image processing is to quantify how much light the lumens they make.
Yeah, so because so far what they have been doing, as I understand, is they have been calculating things by hand. And what we did is we provided them with software. That was my tuition to them, if you like. We provide them with software that they can process thousands of these. On automated fashion, we have given them GUIs. The software, by the way, is on our website. You can download it, and all we ask is that you acknowledge a paper that we have done, if you use it.
So the way you identify edges is basically you have a threshold for the pneumatic auto parameter of the arrows that you show.
So the curvelets is, you can have curvelets of different sizes, and that's what helps you reconstruct your image. Okay, and then at some point you threshold, and we threshold it at the first level.
Okay.
And then this first level, we use that as a classification metric of getting tubes versus sheets.
Okay.
That's all. So now, again, talking about attrition, and this is a project that I did with Donald McDonald when I was in Hanahan's lab. There was another imaging project nearby in Donald McDonald's lab in UCSF, where what he was interested in is he was looking into endothelial cell junctions, and these are different vasculatures. And what he was doing here, he was able to use to tag with fluorescent particles, molecules, the endothelial cell junctions. And then, depending on different treatment, drug treatment that he will give to the vasculature that is formed around tumors, then he would find that these endothelial cell junctions would be expressed, and then you will get very sharp pictures as you get here. So when you see sharp pictures, then that means that the zippers between the endothelial cells have been expressed. If you see things like that, this is not such a good treatment because you don't really see zippers. And the zippers, again, is molecules that they go and they tie these endothelial cells over here. So
images are subcellular now. What's
the images, yeah, these are endothelial cells. I think it's electron microscopy from Donald McDonald's lab. There is a reference here that describes all the protocol of how these were collected. So what they were giving me is images of that kind, and what they were interested in is to classify different types of treatment. These are different drugs that they were giving to the cells, and I was using these curvelets. And I was able to give them very clear classification because it seemed that with all other tools they had at the moment, they could not were not able to distinguish all these different structures. A very challenging imaging problem. So all I claim is that there are imaging tools around, like these curvelets. Again, the credit to Manuel Candes, that you can apply to biology, it's a matter of matching the right thing. And this is what we did with Michael Detmar lab. It's another person who is interested in cancer. Was at Harvard, now he's at ETH. So they were having these wound healing assays, and they were doing these things by hand. So they were measuring, there were scrubs. That's another story, how they scrubs. And then they would measure things like that by hand, and then we gave them a GUI. You take the picture, and then the GUI gives you all the information you want afterwards to quantify. Other things that we have done, again, trying to collect more and more data. Again, area was data that I can get, but there's so many parameters that I have with my particles that I need more detailed data. And then what we did is we actually started looking into cell tracking, isolated single cells, cell layers in wound healing, cell layers in wound healing, and this is different types of imaging. This is phase contrast imaging, if I remember well. And here's another imaging where on top of, they are able to use fluorescence to describe the membrane of the cells in the wound healing assays. And we have been developing tools, different tools for these different domains. In the end, what I understand from imaging, a lot depends on the quality of the experimentalist. Because a lot of things, it was very frustrating, things would be out of focus, they would go out of focus over time, different protocols. So we did some kind of, we tried to use software to identify wound healing assays. And here we did something similar to what you have seen from, I believe, the group of Silverdine, I hope I say the name correctly, where we used an idea from fluid mechanics, particle image velocimetry, where you're looking into trying to track individual velocity fields inside the cell layer. Now, how do you track velocity fields? When you do fluid mechanics, you see the flow with particles. But here you have a little bit of a GIF in the sense that the flow you're interested in seeing already by the cells, and then by looking at certain properties of nuclei or let's say the periphery of the cells, then you're able to extract these velocities. So we're putting a mask down, and then we are interested very much, for example, to quantify based on this masking based on this masking operation, how is the front layer, as we call it, is evolving over time, and we are developing some diagnostics. So what you can develop as diagnostics is the front orientation, the average front orientation. You can determine velocity distribution in the front region, velocity distribution in the rear region. So this tells you that you have in the front region most of the particles are going like that with a higher velocity, and the velocity changes as you go towards the back, but you have also velocities going backwards in certain orientations. Velocity distribution in the whole mass region, initial front orientation, current front orientation, so we can get data like this, if you like. So this is more data that we are very much interested to incorporate into our simulations.
So you're plotting the different different particles.
So here I'm binning the wound healing assay. I'm binning it. I have some radial bins, and then in these bins I'm looking into mean velocities.
Okay.
That's what this thing is.
As time evolves, then the picture changes, right?
Because sorry.
So when the time changes, all the velocity changes.
Of course.
Yeah.
So it's as the thing flows, then you get all this information.
So this is a snapshot of all the particle velocities at a certain.
But on beams. Yeah, average on the beams that I'm showing you here. I just use different ways of representing the data. And another thing we have been looking into individual cells, looking at extension areas and retraction areas, and we are interested here. So we're using something like a radar, if you like, around the cells, and then we're trying to see as the cells are changing. So here, what has happened? There was if you take the gray and the red, this is where the cell was at time frame I. And the gray and the green, this is where the cell is at time frame I plus 1. And this tells us how much the cell has retracted and how much the cell has been extended. And apparently this is interesting information that you can relate to wound healing assays, and we can do processes like this very adaptively. If you notice at the time that the two things come together, I'm dead. My algorithm is dead. But as soon as we can distinguish cells, we are able to extract information and look at extension, regression of cells, as you see here. And this is, again, a more recent work where we combine PID with watershed segmentations, etc. And we're looking into doing these types of tracking in wound healing assays. But the key thing here is to combine PID and image segmentation to be able to track individual cells. And here we have now lots of information. And now I can go back to my subcellular elements and do my reverse engineering with this data. This is work that happened that just finished a month ago. But now we are excited about going to the subcellular elements we have, and I want to see some of the things that you presented yesterday or discussed, if you have time.
Petros, in UCLA we have an image analysis group, and they claim that they're applied mathematicians, that by image analysis they can bring out features that you don't see if you just look at the pictures themselves. So they show pictures and by suitable differential.
I believe them.
Can you give examples?
Well, here's some picture that I can show you, and then you can see where this picture. I have these cells moving earlier. So here's this thing, right? And now what do you get out of this? What do you see? And then what we can do with that is we do all this image segmentation story, and I can provide you. I can provide you with detailed information. Oh, this is the whole processing that we do, and I can provide you with detailed information about cells and its neighborhood.
You can follow individual cells.
Here, yes.
If they divide, if they die,
that's right.
It would be difficult otherwise.
Yeah. So it's very, again, it's very closely related to what the group in France has done, and what we have done is combine it with image segmentation, and we have a lot of analysis, a lot of data that is now interesting. The other thing which we were playing with here is we were changing the substrate. So there are people who are interested in wound healing, what's the effect of substrate. So we're interested in using this data now to quantify effects of substrate, because actually it's very visible. If you take and you process this data, it's very visible as to what kind of substrate you may have just by looking at that. So that's just coming up now to my head. Perhaps by doing the image analysis, you can see things that are perhaps invisible under your cells if you have done the right calibration.
This is not an easy image to segment, I thought.
No. Thank you for remarking that.
What is PIV?
Particle image velocimetry. So what people do in fluid mechanics they take particles, they see the flow. So if you have a flow that's going like that, they see particles, and then they see where these particles arrive in the next frame. And by drawing correlations between their locations, they're able to extract velocity fields and such things. So it's developed by a person called Ron Adrian, I think, first. And it has been extended even to 3D now. So I think there's a lot of interesting things in cross-fertilizing between disciplines. Now, some of the things that we were interested in, and that's actually how we came to work with the group of ISPE, is so then I'm jumping into models that we were doing, and we were very much interested in looking at models like this of cells, and then we were interested in the cell density, and then one of the models that we have is this story here where I have and graded response, and this A of I is the graded velocity, and there's modeling going on. So I can decide cell-cell adhesion models of what these velocities, chemotaxis inside an extracellular matrix, because I have distributed growth factors onto the extracellular matrix, bound growth factors. And then this is perhaps something similar to cell density pressure, if you like, that we were looking at cells around us and trying to come up with a cell density pressure term here. So all this stuff goes in here. Then we wanted to have some stochasticity, if you like, so we have a diffusion, and here's a diffusion, linear diffusion constant, and then we have some models of creation and death. And again, with all these things, how do you calibrate? So we were doing things like that, where we were doing, I'll tell you what's the difference inside and outside. So here is a source of endothelial cells, the source of this density. And then the gray and white matter that you see is a representation of extracellular matrix. And then outside the circle, the extracellular matrix is having growth factors. Inside here, the extracellular matrix has only soluble factors. And if you observe visually, and we're working on that, you can see a lot more branching on the outside of this image than on the inside. And this kind of makes sense because all this extracellular matrix is more randomly distributed, if you like, so there will be obviously more cues for the for this term to follow the extracellular.
Is this a form of invasion percolation? You have a random network and you're injecting material at one spot?
You can see it like that, yeah. You can see it like that.
So does it find particularly wide, by random choice, it finds certain channels which are wider by accident at the center?
Well, what it does...
What's the initial branching?
The distribution, that the first, I guess, thing that it finds over here, the first particles that it finds, and the particular non-uniformity of the initial condition that we had.
Okay.
That's what I would say is what breaks the symmetry. And so now, what we were looking around in the literature. So we found this work by the group of Arispe. where she had shown that if you have only soluble VGF, you can get thicker vessels, and if you have soluble and matrix bound VGF, then you get increased branching. So the next thing for us was to do examples of that kind, where after the blue line here, I start to increase, I start to have matrix bound VGF. It's the same thing as a circle, but now you can imagine that it starts over here for this. And this is the number of the level of the matrix bound VGF that I have. So now, you start getting different patterns, and obviously the more matrix bound VGF, you almost get like a picture of the extracellular matrix in a sense.
Just to understand, so the developing veins can only develop if there is growth factor in the
matrix. That's right, yeah.
And this growth factor is either diffusive or bound to the matrix?
That's right, yeah. So either you have something here, and then the cells have a tendency to follow here, but they also can diffuse and reflect.
Can we eat up the growth factor?
We can add.
So that then you will not get in the neighborhood.
We can add that because we can add matrix metalloprotein acids, and matrix metalloprotein acids, they cleave, if you like, bound growth factors, and then this can add to the volume factors. I can show you this aspect as well. So we have been looking into data of this kind, and then I contacted Luisa and we started working together, and then the story was, what is the right assay to do that? And then she told us that she has some beautiful assays with a retina. This is the blood vessel formation in angiogenic blood vessel formation in the retina of the mouse, and what we try to do now is to take this data and quantify uncertainties or validate this model that we have over here.
So what someone else working on that angiogenesis told me, which I think you could perfectly implement since you really know about hydrodynamics, is he told me that an important thing about it is that if you have flow in the blood vessel, it stays. If you don't have flow, it collapses.
You're jumping to the end of my talk.
Okay, sorry.
Let me show you this.
So you're doing exactly
it's a fine simulation. We're looking into doing blood flow in realistic blood vessel assays.
And the point is that
you
can combine that with angiogenesis, because if there's no flow, actually, the capillary decides to go away.
We do that. I'll find it afterwards if you like.
Okay.
I hope it appears somewhere in my talk. or is it here?
You showed it in a way. I didn't know that you're combining it.
I saw it at some point, yes. Yeah. So now, again, what I want to tell you here is that one thing that is interesting is that we thought that this was easy, but then as it turns out, it's not easy, because you have three layers. You don't have only two layers when you do angiogenesis in the mouse. It's a fascinating topic. So what you have is you have this retina, if you like, and we're looking into the blood vessels inside the retina. And then postnatal day is what P is, post 0 to post 3. Is what happens here, and then post 3 to post 7 is what happens here. So look, you have this thing, and you cut it, and you split it open. And I'm very proud to say that the person who was doing the simulations went to the lab of Luisa, and he did, he worked with him, but he has done a lot of these experiments. And
is this real vasculature, where you get venules and arterioles and capillaries, or is it everything of the same size?
No. It's actually, I'll come to that, because we are interested in classifying it, what kind of venules you have, what kind of capillaries, etc. So
blue and red here means venules?
I'll tell you in a second. So blue and red is different levels. So what you have is you start to get after, in the beginning, day 0 to 3 and 3 to 7, it's all 2D. It's all happening here. But then you start to get the sprouts, these green things that you see here, and they're starting to go down into the third dimension. And then you start to generate these blue level vessels that you have from these sprouts. So after at about this stage, you have one layer over here, and you have a blue layer down there. And then to make things more fun, eventually you get lateral communication between the sprouts, and you get the green layer after that. And what you see here is image reconstructions of looking. So this is the three layers that I told you before. So it's the red that happens in time first, the blue that happens in time second, and the middle layer that happens afterwards, and then the whole vasculature is ready.
Is the green, is it going to become the capillaries, the smallest?
No, you have capillaries in all three layers, and arteries and veins, and what we are interested in is to understand blood flow, and how does the blood flow determine where things are being sprouted.
Is the blood flow like in the brain, that it doesn't have a pure branching structure? Is it like normal blood flow where everything is an exact branch?
I don't know blood flow. I don't know blood flow in the brain.
Blood flow in the brain means that you have circuits, whereas ordinary blood flow, it just keeps branching, goes to the capillaries, gives up oxygen, and it comes back together again. So it's a perfect tree structure.
Yeah.
In the brain, it's reticulated.
So here I know, or we speculate, that there is flow. I actually want to find out more about that. There is flow. I think you should ask Luisa if things, not me. I think there is flow between the different layers.
That's more like the brain.
Yeah, I think there is flow.
And is the difference between P10 and P15? Is
yes.
What I was talking about.
But you don't see
that they disappear, the vessels.
No.
You come closer.
You see these vertical green lines. Now, in this picture here, there's horizontal lines between them. That's what happens here. There's a horizontal green line here.
You can't see.
No, I mean, the difference that I saw that difference. The difference, I mean, is also
yes.
The pink lines.
Yes.
Some of the pink lines disappear.
Yes, that's right.
My guess would be that
that's exactly,
collapse.
Yes. I think I need to find out this movie for you.
No, it's fine.
We are interested, as I said, we are interested now in doing all this analysis, and we have data that we are developing. So we are interested very much, if you like, to quantify things like the sprouting points. So we are interested in doing all this kind of imaging analysis. We are interested in identifying veins, capillaries and arteries, and there is different, because of the flow that you mentioned, we find that there is different distributions of sprouting on capillaries, on veins, and on arteries. So now we start to have quantitative information as to how all these things are evolving in time. So you see that on arteries there is very little sprouting. So that tells us something, that's the effect of the flow. So definitely fluid mechanics is important here, because you can see from this data. So you see that on the capillaries and on the veins, there is a lot of sprouting. And then this is the sprouting density versus distance from the optic nerve of this thing over here. Other things that we are very much interested in, now we're going towards doing the flow in there and to study maturation processes and such things. So this is images we start with. And then we do the Kerlet tintering, and then this becomes the denoised image here. Then we do thresholding. And now if you have very good eyes, you see that what imaging can do to you, and then you have to go somewhere and fix it. If you look here, there is a gap that the imaging has done. You see that? There is a black line. If I try to do a flow, it's going to tell me that there is a gap here, and it's not going to do it. So we have to come up and do a refinement map, where we try to fix, we try to make it automated as possible, but the difference between this thing here and this thing here is that we have been able to fix such problems in an automated fashion. And there is tremendous work by Florian Wilde to do the experiments, do the image analysis, and he does the simulations for that. So we get lots of, and then we start to do pattern detections. We start to look at arteries, and we measure all these kind of parameters, if you like, and then we're trying to classify and quantify this progression. Another thing we're interested is to find proper, maybe you guys can have some ideas about that, is to quantify vascular network morphology. And then we're using these Minkowski functionals that try to give us some kind of quantification. So these are different Minkowski functionals, and this is the different layers that I mentioned before. And then what we're trying to do is it possible to look at Minkowski functionals and say certain specific things about this vasculature. It's our effort to provide numbers as to when you see a network of blood vessels. And this is what I want to do. And I don't have this done yet, but I have it for viruses. So now I can talk about, so what I want to do, as I said, is to have a model, as I have here. Then I want to have some kind of a cost function, and then do this covariance. We have some optimization techniques that we use them to take and change the parameters of this, of whatever quantity of interest we extract, to a quantity of interest we extract from here, and go back and close this loop. I can show you how we have done this loop now for viruses, and then you can see how I determine parameters of a stochastic model from video analysis of virus trajectories, or I can tell you how I used image analysis to do FRAP inside, three-dimensional FRAP analysis inside the endoplasmic reticulum. Or we can stop. What should we do?
Second audience. Viruses.
Viruses. Cool. Viruses it is. Okay, so here's the virus story. The virus story is that you are looking into how viruses are being transported on microtubules, and you don't have a lot of information as to how this thing is working from imaging. So people are speculating, and people, here's another beautiful animation, but actually biologists tell me it's wrong because the cell is much more crowded than this. So you have all these kinesin and DNA motors, and they are transporting cargo inside the cell over microtubules. So the good news is that you have certain directionality here, because I think you have the kinesin moving out from the nucleus and DNA transporting things to the center. And I think the video says this is the FedEx guy of the cell. This is nice, and an animation, and here's when I started interacting with biologists. This was with a group of Ari Helenius, and there was a PhD student, Lucas Kaufmann, today professor, who his PhD thesis, he analyzed three virus trajectories. This was in 2000, and he did it by hand, and that's all he could do. So we worked together with them, and my PhD student, he was Pagherini. And then what we were able to do is we were able to look at all these virus trajectories, and we looked into different metrics of how to classify the motion of the viruses. So all these colors that you see, this imply a different motion of the virus. We have used different ways to classify. One thing that I liked very much was this moment scaling spectrum. I don't know if you're familiar with that, where you you know that in the case that you have diffusion, that you have x squared goes like t to the power of 1, and the idea is that you can have other moments that you can compute like that, and then you generate, you take the trajectories and you do different moments, and then you have in one place the A and in the other the gamma, and then you can get different behaviors. And it can be the case that you can have this thing being like that, but the other moments can be totally different, so that gives you different types of motion. There's a paper where we describe that process as well.
So A here is the distance it's traveled?
It's x squared, yeah, it's the mean squared displacement. Okay, but then you can have other factors, not only two. You can have three, four, five, or whatever.
He's looking how moments like x to the fourth are scaling with time.
That's right.
Hyperscaling.
Yeah.
Or is that just to determine whether your diffusion is solid or sugar?
That's right. Yeah. It helps you very much when you have trajectories to plot your data So this moment scaling spectrum, it's not from us. I think people in physics, I think in oceanography, they have used it before us. The reference, I can give you the references.
You use this if you want to make sure it's a Gaussian or a non-Gaussian process.
I'm using this to classify the different to classify the trajectories that I get here, and I'll show you in a second why I need kind of.
Can you see if they fall off the microtubules?
No, I cannot see if they fall off. Actually, I will have a problem. Maybe from these things. I don't know. We haven't checked, actually. That's a good point. So I'll be interested, actually. So here I'll be interested for the things that I'll do now. I'm interested only in trajectories that they show me some directionality. Okay, so the model, so there's a model for bidirectional transport. So there is stochastic that you have both kinesin and beaming, and there is a tug of war, and at some point one of them wins and the cell moves like that or moves like that. There is exclusionary mechanism that you either have the kinesin or you have the beaming attached to it, and then if you have the beaming you move like that, if you have the kinesin you move like that, or there is some kind of an unknown so far. Perhaps people should find it, or that's what is arguing here. Coordinating complex where you have both of the motors attached, and then this guy picks one up or the other, and the guys are moving left or right. Okay?
And just Brownian motion is not an option here?
Because
attaching from one microtubule and attaching to
not for this. Not, we cannot do that here. This is not the... it could be possible, but this is not one of the in the list that was set up here, and it's something that we've done with a model that I will show you. I cannot exclude it or confirm it either with the next model that I'll show you here. We're looking only the case that you have the cargo being attached to the microtubules all the time.
That's just looking at images, you don't...
I look at videos. I'll show you in a second.
I'll wait till then.
Or is we're doing simulations and we do include Brownian motion. We do simulations.
Yeah, no, but I'm also wondering about the images.
Yes.
So there's some guy in London, I think, in the UK definitely, who's using bidirectional transport in some fungal thing that is like extremely long. And there's also particles, not viruses, but vesicles getting transported from one end to the other. And I think he had pretty convincing, in my opinion, experimental evidence that it was more like you had a vesicle and basically the dynes run. And so the dynes, according to his picture, are the dynes that are relevant in his situation. Of course, you always have to say because there's a few thousand different ones, run along and they capture a vesicle and keep running. And it stops when eventually the dynein detaches actually from the vesicle.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's kinesins on it that run in the opposite direction.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of like the tug of war, just a bit different, because actually the detachment can be on the other side.
Like what you're saying sounds like more like this exclusionary, right? One of them drops off and the other takes over, or?
A bit, it's a bit a mixture of the two, because sort of the exclusion does not work by a binding site that is kind of either dynein or kinesin. It's more something like if dynein is on there, kinesin has no chance, and if dynein detaches, kinesin can go. Mm-hmm. But I can look up the reference.
So this is the model we set up. Let me put down all this model. So here's what we say. So we say that you have a number of available binding sites, and we upper-bound them. I'll come back to that, because we use this information to extract structure eventually. And then we say we have the event where dynein is attached, and then dynein moves. And then we know that the step that the dynein does is about 8 nanometers. And for kinesin is the same. Kinesin is attached, and kinesin moves. Okay, so that's one event, or the move two events here. Then I can have that kinesin unbinds with a certain rate, and then I get free binding sites, or I can have that I lose binding sites and I have bound kinesine, a bound DNA, bound kinesine, and whenever things are bound, then things can move. Okay? So there's no forces here. I explicitly formulated. The key question that you should ask me is, where the heck do I get these numbers?
What rho is the number of bound binding sites on the microtubule?
On the virus capsid, on the cargo.
I see.
That's the upper bound. And I'll tell you where does this, we have varied it at some point, but let's say for a moment is 20 or so a number. And now what we specify, so here's a stochastic model, and I can use a Gillespie algorithm I can use a Monte Carlo, whatever algorithm, Gillespie algorithm here to run these stochastic simulations. I can pre-specify what these parameters are. But now the story of the reverse engineering that I have been telling you is to use data to extract these parameters of my model. Okay? So I'll show you how we do that now and what does it take for us. So we have adenovirus trajectories that they have been in cell of cells. And then what we do is we run the video, the analysis software that we have. And then we extract from that two-dimensional trajectories where our software tells us that we have directed motion. So this is what we have, two-dimensional trajectory of a virus. The virus has started here, and then it does that. Then it does that. We classify this thing as directed motion. Here, this is not classified as directed motion. Here, this is classified again as directed motion. In fact, these things actually could be jumping around from microtubules. This thing does not distinguish between that. It just takes the data and says, when you are in a microtubule, that's a... And that's what we take this data. And then what we do is we take this two-dimensional curve and we make it one-dimensional curve. And we look over different frames. This is, you can relate this to times. You look at what kind of distances have been covered. Okay, so this guy has been not going very far anywhere. Then it covers this distance. So we take this information and we make it a one-dimensional track. And we like to make it one-dimensional track because we are interested on one-dimensional motion, statistics of one-dimensional motion on microtubules. This is an assumption of the model. So now, when I run now this stochastic simulation algorithm, I can pick up different parameters, and I can get also similar story. So let me show you. I'll jump a bit. This is going here. So I can get also from my simulation some data. So we actually collect two types of data. We collect data of length that has been traveled on the microtubule, and we get also velocity. And it's a double peak because you have positive and negative depending if you have kinesin and DNA. So this is statistics. This is a probability distribution, if you like, from the computational model, the red, and the black is biological data. Okay? And this was chosen, this was generated with some initial parameters, and all I do now is I formulate a Kullback-Leibler distance between these two probability distributions using as parameters, the six parameters that I have, and then I perform an optimization using evolutionary optimizations. So I'm using this covariant matrix adaptation technique, which is an evolutionary strategy that uses information as you proceed to adapt your optimization. And this is the cost function. This is where I start at the beginning, and then this is where I arrive at the end. And this is where finally this thing has found parameters for which the two distributions are matching very well. And these are the different parameters that I have. So these are the setting rates for kinesin and DNA. We find them to be in this parameter range, and this is the unbinding and binding rates that I have for the other coefficients. And I want to tell you that this takes thousands of hours in parallel processors because these evolutionary averages are slow. So it takes about 10,000 evaluations to collect statistics, because in each one of these evaluations implies that they have run a lot of statistics for a certain set of parameters to extract a data point.
It's a quick question. So you have this one-dimensional trajectory from the data, right? One-dimensional plotting from the trajectory data. Then why don't you use that as a target function? You use this distribution. So what's the reason?
Because the one trajectory means nothing to me. How do I compare one trajectory with another trajectory? I'm interested in statistics of these things.
Okay, this is for many errors.
It's for many, many runs and a lot of experimental data. Yes.
So let me be devil's advocate here.
Sure.
So this is of course spectacular fit.
Yeah.
And you of course wonder whether this is an over-parameterization on one hand. And so it's surprising that one can fit so well.
Yeah.
And on the other hand, then the question is this a unique fit? Right? By the time you can fit so well, maybe there are very, very many other ways of fitting very well, and none of them particularly meaningful.
So for the last question, I can provide you error bars on the sensitivity of the minima that I have, and they are quite small.
So it's really...
So this thing has found...
Quite typically in this sort of procedure, you find the manifolds, you find surfaces in your parameter space which do well.
Yeah.
But you don't see that.
No, in my case, I find... So this covariance matrix adaptation technique finds a local minimum. This I can accept that there is other solutions.
Well, local minimum is one thing, but what's the...
The sensitivity of this.
Yeah, so are there sort of flat directions coming out of, or relatively...
This is very sharp, relatively sharp. I can dig out the paper and tell you that there are small error bars around here. I just say, this is how the algorithm converges. This is the convergence of the algorithm, and you can see that we have let it go for quite some time after it has found the optimal solution, and then we can monitor also the variances of this algorithm. The landscape is obviously quite noisy, I think, and again, I claim that what I have found is not necessarily a global optimum. As soon as you start to become more correct with evolutionary algorithms, you start to converge to local optima, and this optima I have found has not yet.
Similar question,
sure.
There's an overfitting issue there.
Yeah.
So is there any possibility to reduce the complex signal model? Or
I thought it's just
a minimum model.
I thought that this was a minimum model. If you can tell me what you want me to... Actually, let me show you one more thing, and then you can tell me what I can take out, and we didn't do that.
Another question is, going back to the distribution profile. So you have a length and velocity.
That's right.
Is that measured at a fixed time point, I believe?
No, these are statistics.
Statistics over the long...
Over a lot of trajectories and a lot of data, both from experiments and from simulations.
But what's the meaning of length then? Length distribution means... I think I understand about distribution of velocity. You can measure it for... What does it mean by length?
The distance that you have covered in a certain run that you have done. So I take this data and I do statistics on this data. So this is a long run. This is a long run. Forget the luck. These two numbers go together in helping out my mean in that location. That's the statistics, if you like, that we do.
If you start your optimization at very wildly different parameter values,
yes,
you get the same.
Well, no, we have done that. Yes, and we do recap, but it's a six parameter dimensional space. I mean, we have started maybe for four or five initial conditions. This means nothing in a sense about that.
Okay.
What if
I mean, another thing you should know, these algorithms, the way they optimize is like this. I think it's important to see. This is how you, what is the optimization. So this is the cost function over here that I just saw, it's called by Leibler thing. And then this is how the algorithm works. It's kind of a, it's almost Markov chain Monte Carlo, but that's another story. So what you do is you start, and you start with a center point, and then this is initial conditions. So this answers your question, but I can tell you we have taken this point and we have started it in other places as well. So that's in addition to, so there's even more than 5 points, but still. So then you generate candidate solutions, and then you do your evaluations, and let's say you find, let's say you have a cost function that, this is a parameter phase, the cost function minimizes like that. You find that these are 3 better ones from all the others. You find the mean of that, and then you put, now you don't put a circle, but you change the covariance matrix of this Gaussian probability distribution from which you sample point. So you started with a circle, and now because you have moved in that direction, you have a new covariance matrix that is more elongated in that direction. So in a sense, you start to do stochastic gradients approximation, and that's the reason you get stuck in local minima, because you are not exploring anymore, but at some point you go down a valley, and I cannot tell you that this is the global minimum.
So x1 and x2 are your parameters.
That's right.
For example, and these points are just sort of guesses at what the parameters.
I'm sampling a Gaussian probability distribution. I'm sampling this.
Okay.
And what is interesting about this technique comes from this guy Hansen, who was also a postdoc in our lab. Nico, is you change the covariance matrix using the past history. The algorithm is available also on our website in every kind of possible format. We have done a lot of benchmarking, and you're welcome to use it for your purposes if you find it useful.
So I actually have a question about the benchmarking. It's very interesting.
Yeah.
So you use recombination and mutation, right? So how much do you gain from using recombination?
How much do I gain from using recombination?
Presumably as you...
So this is not a genetic algorithm. Huh? This is working on the floating points.
Yeah.
This is not doing the...
If I understand correctly, so you just recombine your parameter sets.
Yes, you do in the recombination. There is an answer to your question, but I don't remember it. I think it is important, but I don't remember right now. This is an important question. Yes.
Yeah. Just according to your results, what was the number of binding? I mean, you said p number of binding sites.
Now we can do that.
Was how many?
Now we can do that. Now it's fine. Now the fun begins, because we get this data. This is some of the. There is a high, I take back the small error bars. Down here there is high sensitivity on this, on binding. I should present this plot with the error bars. So there is high sensitivity on the binding and unbinding rates. But nevertheless, it's a small factor of the stepping rates. I come to that. Okay. I come to your question now. So that's. I should put quotes here. Okay, according to our model, I think we believe that our model supports this stochastic tug-of-war idea, because we have a model that allows both of them to be active at the same time. Of course, our model does not have explicit exclusion of motor coordination, but definitely we found no evidence for that. So we have found some evidence for this.
I'm confused. Your model seems based on the exclusionary mechanism.
No, because at this time you have both of these particles attached.
Well, but you have only one p, right? And if it wants to become d or k,
No, it's not that you have the parameters that you get, the binding and unbinding rates. They're not one is zero and the other one is. Well, you get them both on.
But can I go back to the model model mechanism slide you showed?
This one?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, because here, it seems the P only becomes D or K at a certain time. It doesn't become like...
So this is a stochastic simulation. Mm-hmm. Depending on the propensity of this mm-hmm. and the propensity of this, mm-hmm. an event will be selected.
Yes.
Okay?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. But this does not mean that if I run... So forget all the other stuff. So this does not mean that if this event is selected, that there is no kinesin on at that time.
Okay, so you have a case where the D and K both run to the same.
That's right. D and K are attached to the thing, and then I have, depending on how many of them there are, there is a propensity, yes, that I have, and then that, yeah, yes.
So does the rate of unbinding from the microtubule depend on the load on the motor? Or the force?
So that's a
the type of war you would expect forces.
Yeah, we don't have access to force measurements. And there are people.
There are force measurements.
There are force measurements, but not for in vivo or in vivo data. Or so they take individual cells and individual motors and they do the force.
Right, the force measurements are all.
So that's a difference of what's the advantage of this? That you do not have force explicitly involved, but you do it on in vivo data. And there are questions whether...
But your unbinding parameters, therefore, independent of force.
One way to say it is like that. A more advantageous to me way is that the force is inside this. But I don't know what it is.
But then I would expect that if you try to reproduce in vitro experiments, you wouldn't get the right thing because the force velocity curves you get wouldn't...
I don't have any force velocity here.
Correct, but I mean, if you took these parameters and said, well, I think the motors would act the same in vitro, and then I try to reproduce experiments that have been done in vitro to do force velocity curves, you wouldn't get the right thing because you don't have any force dependence.
I wouldn't get the right thing in
the
what
right
sense?
Force velocity curves that are measured.
But I cannot have force velocity curves. I don't have.
You don't have, I know, but then the motors, you don't explain what the motors do in vitro.
No. I don't explain force velocity relationships. I agree with you. All I'm trying to explain is the scenario whether both of them are attached or not. And this supports this type of thing.
Right, it's kind of where you would expect there's forces, right? There's tugging.
Yeah, sure.
So
sure. But I cannot in this model there's no forces.
Okay.
It'd be nice to come up with some way of a model where one can introduce forces, but again, as far as I am, I saw this to show you the thinking of using experimental data and extracting information and taking parameters of, that's for me the what is, I think, interesting. I agree with you, this may be, in a sense, also irrelevant, if you like, to reality, or it's probably room for improvement of this. But well, I think the process is interesting.
I mean, just as you cite Gross's work, he doesn't believe in type of war, just as a footnote.
Let me show you what other things we get out of this, and it refers to your question. So then the other thing that we started to look at the possible binding sites. And now this is why this is interesting. This is interesting because if you know what are the proteins in a virus that are the binding sites for the kinesin and the DNA, perhaps you can come up with drugs that they can try to destroy this particular binding site, so this guy cannot be transported on microtubules. Now, I hope I will not mess this up with my numbers, because it's been a while. This is 2 years, actually. That's a long time. So there are pentons on the surface of the virus. There are hexons, and then there is this P9s, and I think these are the P9s, and these are the hexons. So what we did is we took what you were mentioning, so we changed the binding sites that we can have on the as a parameter in our whole simulation. And then this is the cost function, the minimum cost function that we could achieve. And then what was interesting is that for the particular data that we had, we got this type of variation. So when we started giving a lot of binding sites, we started not to really be able to get any convergence to a good meaning between the two distributions. So we couldn't get the algorithm to converge to a minimum. And we found that by changing this binding sites, there is an area over here between 10 and 15 where the algorithm consistently finds a relatively good minimum for our cost function. So that tells you, if you like, the sensitivity of this thing in terms of the binding sites.
Why? I don't even understand why it's sensitive to the number of binding sites.
It depends. I guess once you start to get a lot of these guys on top, then you get a lot of noise in your simulated cost function.
You have multiple attachments, and then they can't walk.
Either they can't walk, or I have a lot of noise in my cost function, and this thing, my algorithm does not converge, does not find.
If it only attaches with one, right, you basically don't care how many, it just multiplies into attachment probability. So you would only care about the many attachment sites if you create multiple attachment sites, which then start fighting each other, that would screw up the motility.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. No, that's, that could be the...
So these are sites on the virus that attach the motor?
That's right.
But typically, viruses, for example, polio sheds its coat, goes in with just bare RNA, or viruses are often endosomally encapsulated by some membrane.
This is adenovirus. This is an adenovirus that apparently you can... So when you have the cytosolic viruses, this particular adenoviruses, that my biologist here, which is Urs Greber from Zurich, tell us that there are three polypeptides that are still present when these guys are inside the cytosol. So then we looked at what could be the candidate binding sites. So one candidate binding site could be this hexon-hexon interfaces. Also, you have to take into account that there is a microtubule with about this size that this guy has to be under and attaching to between that and the virus, all this protein 9 type of thing. And what this thing suggests over here, by the numbers, the number that will satisfy to be somewhere between 10 and 12, is the hexon-hexon interfaces and not the protein 9. That's what this argument shows, and that's what these interfaces that you have over here correspond, these numbers correspond.
Is it known for that case? Which
and let me finish. And then this is actually, if you destroy, they can destroy this this protein, and this is a P9 deficient virus, and we still get basically the same type of probability distributions for the velocity and the length that these viruses do, which indicates that these guys don't affect how much what's going on in here. Go ahead.
Is it known which exact motor proteins it is? You're saying dynes and kinesins. And if, there's a zoo of kinesins and a somewhat smaller zoo of dynes.
Yeah.
Typically, I think the dynein is much bigger than the kinesin. So I would worry about if they actually attach to the same binding site. And is the biology like that known for that virus?
Don't know myself this biology. Okay. I don't know this biology. I certainly did not take into account all the sizes in the model that I have. Yeah. That's the... Mm-hmm. So that's one of the things that came out. This is all the data that came out of directed motions at micrometer per second velocities, processing over hundreds of nanometers and periods of stationary behavior. We believe that there is no explicit coordination mechanism. I believe Gross, now that I remember, calls for that and looks for that. Is that correct?
Yeah, it's either coordination on the cargo or else you put on proteins on the microtubule.
Yeah. then we find that the dynamics is dominated by a low number of motor proteins, and then that's actually, I think now there is biological evidence that this is the case. People have been able to detect this, but for us, based on, if you follow the argumentation I presented you, we could say that please look at hexon-hexon interfaces as the first candidate. So I suggest we go for lunch, and I can talk again.
Yeah.
It's so like about that stuff.
We'll stop the answer.
I'm happy to talk to anybody in detail if
right.
You like about this.
Yeah.